I hope that you will be with me when I die. But that will be at some distant date. He shakes his head. If you had seen how Suffolk sat on me today, he, Norfolk, Thomas Boleyn, Thomas Lord Darcy, they have been waiting only for this, for my failure with this court. And now I hear they are devising a book of articles. They are drawing up a list of accusations, how I have reduced the nobility, and so forth. They are making a book called, what will they call it? 20 Years of Insults. They are brewing some stew pot into which they are pouring the dregs of every slight, as they conceive it, by which they mean every piece of truth I have told them. He takes a great rattling breath and looks at the ceiling which is embossed with the Tudor rose. There will be no such stew pots in your Grace's kitchen, he says. He gets up. He looks at the Cardinal, and all he can see is more work to be done. Liz Wicks, Mercy says, wouldn't have wanted her girls dragged about the countryside, especially as Anne, to my knowledge, cries if she does not see you. Anne, he's amazed, Anne cries. What did you think? Mercy asks with some asperity. Do you think your children don't love you? He lets her make the decision. The girls stay at home. It's the wrong decision. Mercy hangs outside their door, the signs of the sweating sickness. She says, how has this happened? We scour, we scrub the floors. I do not think you will find in the whole of London a cleaner house than ours. We say our prayers. I have never seen a child pray as Anne does. She prays as if she's going into battle. Anne falls ill first. Mercy and Joanne shout at her and shake her to keep her awake, since they say if you sleep, you will die. But the pull of the sickness is stronger than they are, and she falls exhausted against the bolster, struggling for breath, and falls further into black stillness, only her hand moving, the fingers clenching and unclenching. He takes it in his own, and tries to still it, but it is like the hand of a soldier, itching for a fight. Later she rouses herself, asks for her mother. She asks for the copybook in which she has written her name. At dawn the fever breaks. Joanne bursts into tears of relief, and Mercy sends her away to sleep. Anne struggles to sit up. She sees him clearly. She smiles. She says his name. They bring a basin of water strewn with rose petals, and wash her face. A finger reaches out, tentative, to push the petals below the water, so each of them becomes a vessel shipping water, a cup, a perfumed grail. But when the sun comes up, her fever rises again. He will not let them begin it again, the pinching and pummeling, the shaking. He gives her into God's hands, and asks God to be good to him. He talks to her, but she makes no sign that she hears. He is not himself afraid of contagion. If the Cardinal can survive this plague 4 times, I am sure I am in no danger, and if I die, I have made my will. He sits with her, watching her chest heaving, watching her fight and lose. He is not there when she dies. Grace has already taken sick, and he is seeing her put to bed. So he's out of the room, just. And when they usher him in, her stern little face has relaxed into sweetness. She looks passive, placid. Her hand is already heavy, and heavy beyond his bearing. He comes out of the room. He says, she was already learning Greek. Of course, Mercy says. She was a wonderful child, and your true daughter. She leans against his shoulder and cries. She says, she was clever and good, and in her way, you know, she was beautiful. His thought had been, she was learning Greek. Perhaps she knows it now. Grace dies in his arms. She dies easily, as naturally as she was born. He eases her back against the damp sheet. A child of impossible perfection. Her fingers uncurling like thin white leaves. I never knew her, he thinks. I never knew I had her. It has all seemed impossible to him that some act of his gave her life. Some unthinking thing that he and Liz did on some unmemorable night. They had intended the name to be Henry for a boy, Catherine for a girl, and Liz had said, "That will do honour to your cat as well." But when he had seen her, swaddled, beautiful, finished and perfect, he had said quite another thing, and Liz had agreed. We cannot earn grace. We do not merit it. He asked the priest if his elder daughter can be buried with her copybook, in which she has written her name, Anne Cromwell. The priest says he's never heard of such a thing. He's too tired and angry to fight. His daughters are now in purgatory, a country of slow fires and ridged ice. Where in the Gospels does it say purgatory? Tyndale says, "Now abideth faith, hope, and love, even these three, but the greatest of these is love." Thomas More thinks it is a wicked mistranslation. He insists on charity. He would chain you up for a mistranslation. He would, for a difference in your Greek, kill you. He wonders again if the dead need translators. Perhaps in a moment, in a simple twist of unbecoming, they know everything they need to know. Tyndale says, "Love never falleth away." October comes in. Wolsey presides, as usual, over the meetings of the King's Council. But in the law courts, as Michaelmas term opens, writs are moved against the Cardinal. He is charged with success. He is charged with the exercise of power. Specifically, he's charged with asserting a foreign jurisdiction in the King's realm, that is to say, with exercising his role as papal legate. What they mean to say is this. He is alter rex. He is, he has always been, more imperious than the king. For that, if it is a crime, he is guilty. So now they swagger into York Place, the Duke of Suffolk, the Duke of Norfolk, the two great peers of the realm. Suffolk, his blonde beard bristling, looks like a pig amongst truffles. A florid man, he remembers, turns my Lord Cardinal sick. Norfolk looks apprehensive, and as he turns over the Cardinal's possessions, it is clear that he expects to find wax figures, perhaps of himself, perhaps with long pins stuck through them. The Cardinal has done his feats by a compact with the devil. That is his fixed opinion. He, Cromwell, sends them away. They come back. They come back with further and higher commissions and better signatures. And they bring with them the master of the rolls. They take the great seal from my Lord Cardinal. Norfolk glances sideways at him and gives him a fleeting, ferrety grin. He doesn't know why. "Come and see me," the Duke says. "Why, my lord?" Norfolk turns down his mouth. He never explains. "When?" "No hurry," Norfolk says. "Come when you've mended your manners." It is the 19th of October, 1529. Chapter 3. Make or Mar. All Hallows, 1529. Halloween. The world's edge seeps and bleeds. This is the time when the tally keepers of purgatory, its clerks and jailers, listen in to the living, who are praying for the dead. At this time of year, with their parish, he and Liz would keep vigil. They would pray for Henry Wicks, her father, for Liz's dead husband, Thomas Williams, for Walter Cromwell, and for distant cousins, for half-forgotten names, long-dead half-sisters, and lost stepchildren. Last night he kept the vigil alone. He lay awake, wishing Liz back, waiting for her to come and lie beside him. It's true he is at Esher with the Cardinal, not at home at the Austin Friars. But, he thought, she'll know how to find me. She'll look for the Cardinal, drawn through the space between worlds by incense and candlelight. Wherever the Cardinal is, I will be. At some point he must have slept. When daylight came, the room felt so empty. It was empty even of him. All Hallows' Day. Grief comes in waves. Now it threatens to capsize him. He doesn't believe that the dead come back. But that doesn't stop him from feeling the brush of their fingertips, wingtips against his shoulder. Since last night, they've been less individual forms and faces than a solid, aggregated mass, their flesh slapping and jostling together, their texture dense like sea creatures, their faces sick with an undersea sheen. Now he stands in a window embrasure, Liz's prayer book in hand. His daughter Grace liked to look at it, and today he can feel the imprint of her small fingers under his own. These are Our Lady's prayers for the canonical hours, the pages illuminated by a dove, a vase of lilies. The office is matins, and Mary kneels on a floor of checkered tiles. The angel greets her, and the words of his greeting are written on a scroll which unfurls from his clasped hands as if his palms are speaking. His wings are coloured, heaven blue. He turns the page. The office is Lord's. Here is a picture of the visitation. Mary, with her neat little belly, is greeted by her pregnant cousin, St. Elizabeth. Their foreheads are high, their brows plucked, and they look surprised, as indeed they must be. One of them is a virgin, the other advanced in years. Spring flowers grow at their feet, and each of them wears an airy crown made of gilt wires as fine as blonde hairs. He turns a page. Grace, silent and small, turns the page with him. The office is prime. The picture is the Nativity. A tiny white Jesus lies in the folds of his mother's cloak. The office is sext. The Magi proffer jewelled cups. Behind them is a city on a hill. A city in Italy, with its bell tower, its view of rising ground and its misty line of trees. The office is known. Joseph carries a basket of doves to the temple. The office is Vespers. A dagger sent by Herod makes a neat hole in a shocked infant. A woman throws up her hands in protest, or prayer, her eloquent, helpless palms. The infant corpse scatters three drops of blood, each one shaped like a tear. Each bloody tear is a precise vermilion. He looks up. Like an after-image, the form of the tears swims in his eyes. The picture blurs. He blinks. Someone is walking towards him. It is George Cavendish. His hands washed together. His face is a mask of concern. "Let him not speak to me," he prays. "Let George pass on." "Master Cromwell," he says, "I believe you are crying. What is this? Is there bad news about our master?" He tries to close Liz's book, but Cavendish reaches out for it. "Ah, you are praying." He looks amazed. Cavendish cannot see his daughter's fingers touching the page, or his wife's hands holding the book. George simply looks at the pictures upside down. He takes a deep breath and says, "Thomas?" "I'm crying for myself," he says. "I'm going to lose everything. Everything I have worked for all my life, because I will go down with the Cardinal. No, George, don't interrupt me. Because I have done what he asked me to do, and been his friend, and the man at his right hand. If I had stuck to my work in the city instead of hurtling about the countryside making enemies, I'd be a rich man, and you, George, I'd be inviting you out to my new country house and asking your advice on furniture and flower beds. But look at me. I'm finished." George tries to speak. He utters a consolatory bleat. "Unless," he says, Unless, George, what do you think? I've sent my boy Rafe to Westminster. What will he do there? But he is crying again. The ghosts are gathering. He feels cold. His position is irretrievable. In Italy, he learned a memory system, so he can remember everything, every stage of how he got here. I think, he says, I should go after him. Please, says Cavendish, not before dinner. No, because we need to think how to pay off my lord's servants. A moment passes. He unfolds the prayer book to himself. He holds it in his arms. Cavendish has given him what he needs, an accountancy problem. George, he says, you know my lord's chaplains have flocked here after him, all of them earning, what, £100, £200 a year, out of his liberality? So I think we will make the chaplains and the priests pay off the household servants. Because what I think is, what I notice is, that his servants love my lord more than his priests do. So, now let's go to dinner, and after dinner I will make the priests ashamed. And I will make them open their veins and bleed money. We need to give the household a quarter's wages at least, and a retainer. Against the day of my lord's restoration. Well, says George, if anyone can do it, you can. He finds himself smiling. Perhaps it's a grim smile, but he never thought he would smile today. He says, when that's done, I shall leave you. I shall be back as soon as I have made sure of a place in the Parliament. But it meets in 2 days. How will you manage it now? I don't know. But someone must speak for my lord, or they will kill him. He sees the hurt and shock. He wants to take the words back, but it is true. He says, I can only try. I'll make or mar before I see you again. George almost bows. Make or mar, he murmurs. It was ever your common saying? Cavendish walks about the household, saying, Thomas Cromwell was reading a prayer book. Thomas Cromwell was crying. Only now does George realize how bad things are. Once, in Thessaly, there was a poet called Simonides. He was commissioned to appear at a banquet, given by a man called Scopas, and recite a lyric in praise of his host. Poets have strange vagaries, and in his lyric Simonides incorporated verses in praise of Castor and Pollux, the heavenly twins. Scopas was sulky, and said he would pay only half the fee. As for the rest, get it from the twins. A little later, a servant came into the hall. He whispered to Simonides, there were two young men outside, asking for him by name. He rose and left the banqueting hall. He looked around for the two young men, but he could see no one. As he turned back to go and finish his dinner, he heard a terrible noise of stone splitting and crumbling. He heard the cries of the dying as the roof of the hall collapsed. Of all the diners, he was the only one left alive. The bodies were so broken and disfigured that the relatives of the dead could not identify them. But Simonides was a remarkable man. Whatever he saw was imprinted on his mind. He led each of the relatives through the ruins, and pointing to the crushed remains, he said, "There is your man." In linking the dead to their names, he worked from the seating plan in his head. It is Cicero who tells us this story. He tells us how, on that day, Simonides invented the art of memory. He remembered the names, the faces, some sour and bloated, some blithe, some bored. He remembered exactly where everyone was sitting at the moment the roof fell in. Part 3, Chapter 1, Three-Card Trick, Winter 1529 to Spring 1530. Joanne. You say, Rafe, go and find me a seat in the new Parliament. And off he goes, like a girl who's been told to bring the washing in. It was harder than that, Rafe says. Joanne says, how would you know? Seats in the Commons are largely in the gift of lords. Of lords, bishops, the king himself. A scanty handful of electors, if pressured from above, usually do as they're told. Rafe has got him Taunton. It's Wolsey terrain. They wouldn't have let him in if the king had not said yes. If Thomas Howard had not said yes. He had sent Rafe to London to scout the uncertain territory of the Duke's intentions, to find out what lies behind that ferrety grin. Am obliged, master. Now he knows. The Duke of Norfolk, Rafe says, believes my Lord Cardinal has buried treasure, and he thinks you know where it is. They talk alone. Rafe. He'll ask you to go and work for him.
Yes.
Perhaps not in so many words. He watches Rafe's face as he weighs up the situation. Norfolk is already, unless you count the king's bastard son, the realm's premier nobleman. I assured him, Rafe says, of your respect, your reverence, your desire to be at his, commandment, more or less. And what did he say?
He said,
He laughs. And was that his tone?
It was his tone.
And his grim nod?
Yes.
Very well. I dry my tears, those tears from All Hallows' Day. I sit with the Cardinal by the fire at Esher, in a room with a smoking chimney. I say, my lord, do you think I would forsake you? I locate the man in charge of chimneys and hearths. I give him orders. I ride to London, to Blackfriars. The day is foggy. St. Hubert's Day. Norfolk is waiting, to tell me he will be a good lord to me. The Duke is now approaching 60 years old, but concedes nothing to the calendar. Flint-faced and keen-eyed, he is lean as a gnawed bone, and as cold as an axe-head. His joints seem knitted together of supple chain-links, and indeed he rattles a little as he moves, for his clothes conceal relics. In tiny jewelled cases, he has shavings of skin and snippets of hair, and set into medallions he wears splinters of martyrs' bones. "Marry," he says, for an oath, "and by the mass." And sometimes he takes out one of his medals or charms, from wherever it is hung about his person, and kisses it in a fervour, calling on some saint or martyr to stop his current rage getting the better of him. "St. Jude, give me patience," he will shout. Probably he has mixed them up with Job, whom he heard about in the story when he was a little boy at the knee of his first priest. It's hard to imagine the Duke as a little boy, or in any way younger or different from the self he presents now. He thinks the Bible a book unnecessary for laypeople, though he understands priests make some use of it. He thinks book reading an affectation altogether, and wishes there were less of it at court. His niece is always reading, Anne Boleyn, which is perhaps why she is unmarried at the age of 28. He does not see why it's a gentleman's business to write letters. There are clerks for that. Now he fixes an eye red and fiery. "Cromwell, I am content you are a burgess in the Parliament." He bows his head. "My lord, I spoke to the King for you, and he is also content. You will take his instructions in the Commons, and mine. Will they be the same, my lord?" The Duke scowls. He paces. He rattles a little. At last he bursts out. "Damn it all, Cromwell, why are you such a person?" It isn't as if you could afford to be. He waits, smiling. He knows what the Duke means. He is a person. He is a presence. He knows how to edge blackly into a room so that you don't see him. But perhaps those days are over. "Smile away," says the Duke. "Wolsey's household is a nest of vipers, not that..." He touches a medal, flinching. "God forbid I should..." Compare a prince of the church to a serpent. The Duke wants the Cardinal's money, and he wants the Cardinal's place at the King's side. But then again, he doesn't want to burn in hell. He walks across the room, he slaps his hands together, he rubs them, he turns. The King is preparing to quarrel with you, Master. Oh, yes. He will favour you with an interview, because he wishes to understand the Cardinal's affairs. But he has, you will learn, a very long and exact memory. And what he remembers, Master, is when you were a burgess of the Parliament before this, and how you spoke against his war. I hope he doesn't think still of invading France. God damn you! What Englishman does not? We own France. We have to take back our own. A muscle in his cheek jumps. He paces, agitated. He turns. He rubs his cheek. The twitch stops. And he says in a voice perfectly matter-of-fact, "Mind you, you're right." He waits. "We can't win," the Duke says, "but we have to fight as if we can. Hang the expense, hang the waste, money, men, horses, ships. That's what's wrong with Wolsey, you see, always at the treaty table. How can a butcher's son understand La Gloire? Are you a butcher's son? A blacksmith's. Are you really? Shoe a horse?" He shrugs. "If I were put to it, my lord, but I can't imagine..." "You can't. What can you imagine? A battlefield? A camp? The night before a battle? Can you imagine that? I was a soldier myself." "Were you so?" "Not in any English army, I'll be bound. There, you see." The Duke grins, quite without animosity. "I knew there was something about you. I knew I didn't like you, but I couldn't put my finger on it. Where were you?" "Garigliano." "With?" "The French." The Duke whistles. "Wrong side, lad." "So I noticed." "With the French," he chuckles. "With the French. And how did you scramble out of that disaster?" "I went north. Got into..." He's going to say money, but the Duke wouldn't understand trading in money. "Cloth," he says. "Silk, mostly. You know what the market is with the soldier over there." "By the mass, yes. Johnny Freelance, he puts his money on his back. Those Switzers. Like a troop of play actors. Lace, stripes, fancy hats. Easy target, that's all. Longbowman." "Now and then," he smiles. "On the short side for that." "Me too. Now, Henry draws a bow. Very nice. Got the height for it. Got the arm. Still... we won't win many battles like that any more." "Then how about not fighting any?" "Negotiate, my lord. It's cheaper." "I tell you, Cromwell, you've got face coming here." "My lord, you sent for me." "Did I?" Norfolk looks alarmed. "It's come to that." The King's advisers are preparing no fewer than 44 charges against the Cardinal. They range from the violation of the statutes of praemunire, that is to say, the upholding of a foreign jurisdiction within the king's realm, to buying beef for his household at the same price as the king, from financial malfeasance to failing to halt the spread of Lutheran heresies. The law of praemunire dates from another century. No one who is alive now quite knows what it means. From day to day it seems to mean what the king says it means. The matter is argued in every talking shop in Europe. Meanwhile, my Lord Cardinal sits, and sometimes mutters to himself, and sometimes speaks aloud, saying, "Thomas, my colleges! Whatever happens to my person, my colleges must be saved. Go to the king. Whatever vengeance, for whatever imagined injury he would like to wreak on me, he surely cannot mean to put out the light of learning." In exile at Isha, the Cardinal paces and frets. The great mind which once revolved the affairs of Europe now cogitates ceaselessly on its own losses. He lapses into silent inactivity, brooding as the light fails. "For God's sake, Thomas," Cavendish begs him, "don't tell him you're coming if you're not." "I won't," he says, "and I am coming, but sometimes I am held up. The House sits late, and before I leave Westminster, I have to gather up the letters and petitions to my Lord Cardinal, and talk with all the people who want to send messages, but don't want them put into writing.